All right, good evening to everyone. Welcome again to The Law and the Lords, Part 3. Tonight we'll be looking at the famous case of Korematsu versus the United States and generally the Torah's view on the rights of civilians in wartime. We're sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Ravari Leib, and our Talmud Torah tonight should be a schus for Shlema for Rachel Yehudis Bas Mancha Zissel. So this case is over 60 years old, dates back to World War II, but it's very, very modern in its implications and challenges and ramifications. We still deal with it today. By today, I mean literally today. But every society, ancient and modern, wrestles with the issue of civilian rights in wartime. A nation might be a democracy or a constitutional republic. It might be very vigilant about civil liberties. It might have an ongoing debate, an argument about it. It might even have very vibrant organizations protecting civil liberties in the most extreme cases. And yet, war poses a different set of problems and priorities. So to look at it from today's perspective in just one aspect, you'll all recall now almost 10 years ago that the USA Patriot Act was enacted by Congress. It enraged the liberals going back to the time of its passage in October 2001, just 7 weeks after the Arab terror of September 11th. Now the USA Patriot Act, almost no one knows, is actually an acronym. It has nothing to do with patriotism, theoretically, but it was used to sell it. And even President Bush writes that he thought it very corny and counterproductive. But the name of the act was, you could follow the letters, Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism, Act of 2001. Hence the acronym. The other title was unwieldy. But more important than the name, what the Patriot Act did was enhance law enforcement authorities' ability to intercept phone calls and emails of suspected terrorists, to monitor their financial transactions, to increase surveillance on them, all things that were technically illegal under the law, to have indefinite detentions of illegal immigrants, enhanced subpoena power to get agencies, including libraries, for example, to turn over their records about particular people and then barring them from informing the subject about what was happening to him. It was very hotly debated, very criticized by many, and yet the USA Patriot Act passed the House by 357 to 66 and the Senate 98 to 1. Nobody wants to be on record as being against something called the USA Patriot Act. When it was about to lapse 5 years later, it had a sunset provision in order not to permanently enshrine these violations of U.S. norms. The same theatrics. But again, it was passed again in almost identical form. And despite all of his criticism, President Obama himself signed another extension in early 2010, anathema to his base, but still permitting roving wiretaps and seizure of records and enhanced surveillance without probable cause that any crime was about to be committed. All reflective of a fairly obvious notion by modern standards. I remember when Condoleezza Rice testified before Congress about a variety of issues. She was the NSC advisor then. She said, we don't want to wake up one day to a smoking cloud above us. So therefore, compromises have to be made that are, in a sense, violations of American law in order to preclude that from happening. Now, the truth is that most of the USA Patriot Act, if not all of it, does not affect most of us. What does affect us is the intrusiveness of government security personnel at airports, subjecting travelers to searches and indiscretions that were unheard of and unacceptable not long ago. All of this, all these compromises, all these deviations from the norm reflect a statement by Justice Robert Jackson, who incidentally had been the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, took a leave of absence from the Supreme Court to do that. Jackson wrote in a dissent in Terminiello versus the United States, a case involving a rabid priest who spoke in a very inflammatory way in public. His conviction was overturned. But Jackson wrote, "This court has gone far toward accepting the doctrine that civil liberty means the removal of all restraints from these crowds, and that all local attempts to maintain order are impairments of the liberty of the citizen. The choice is not between order and liberty. It is between liberty with order and anarchy without either. There is a danger that if the court does not temper its doctrinaire logic with a little practical wisdom, it will convert the Constitutional Bill of Rights into a suicide pact." That became a famous phrase. Actually, he was just channeling Abraham Lincoln, who'd said a similar thing. And Lincoln, one of the most popular and probably successful presidents, in 1861, at the very beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln ordered some Maryland politicians jailed without trial, including the mayor of Baltimore, who was a Confederate sympathizer. Lincoln officially suspended the writ of habeas corpus. That's a mandate by which prisoners can appeal for release from unlawful detainment by the authorities. It's a right that's guaranteed under the Constitution, Article 1, except in case of rebellion or invasion when public safety may require it. But Lincoln just had people en masse arrested and held without trial. What's that?
Wasn't approved by Congress.
It was second. He was challenged in court, all right, and he was ordered to release the detainees, and he simply refused. And in that, Congress supported him, because remember, the Confederate politicians had already seceded, so the Congress was made up almost exclusively of Unionists. Right, over a year and a half later, Lincoln did release them. But imagine today a situation wherein a president blatantly violates the law, is told by the court to overturn it, and simply says no. And it's an impeachable offense, obviously, but the answer, the pretext is, it's wartime. In wartime, everything is different. Or, in 1917, right after the U.S. entered World War I, the Woodrow Wilson administration, governor of New Jersey at one time, pushed through what it called the Espionage Act and later the Sedition Act. Get this, it banned criticism of the government. It banned any expression in public of pro-German sentiments, and it banned as well any actions or speech that would impair the war effort, which is very, very vague and ambiguous and loosely defined. So, for example, there's a Jew named Robert Goldstein was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was one of the early movie producers. He produced a film called The Spirit of 76. Some of you may have even seen it in its premiere. It came out, I guess, 1918. Mitchell was there, I think. It was about the Revolutionary War. It was deemed to be too anti-British. And Britain was an American ally at the time. He was sentenced to prison under the Sedition Act. The law was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1919, Schenck versus the United States, that banned any speech that was a clear and present danger. That's when the phrase was coined. And the decision in Schenck is still on the books. The interpretation has been amended by the courts over the years, especially in the 60s and 70s, to reflect greater permissiveness. But it's still there. The bottom line is the Constitution is not a suicide pact, and we don't have to fully protect the civil liberties of those who, if successful, would deprive civil liberties to others. Today, it's Muslim Arabs, in a sense, that are in the crosshairs. In the 1940s, it was the Japanese, and we come therefore to Korematsu versus the United States. Here's the case. Fred Korematsu was a Japanese-American, born in Oakland, California, in 1919, just 2 months after the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. It's the 70th anniversary, two days from now. 2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, President Roosevelt signed an executive order, 9066, ordering all Japanese Americans into internment camps or relocation camps that will be set up to house them meaning American citizens of Japanese descent, during the war. Now, the goal was to attempt to counter what was assumed to be a fifth column at a time when rumors were persistent in America that the Japanese were planning a land invasion of the West Coast. Remember, most of the American Navy had been destroyed at Pearl Harbor, so the coast basically was defenseless, and they assumed the Japanese would want to launch a land invasion, as well as they would find natural allies among the Japanese American population. That neither happened was small comfort to the victims. They were imprisoned not because of anything they did, but because of their race and their ancestry. In all, about 120,000 Japanese Americans were interned in these facilities during the war, scattered about the western United States. Now, maybe 5-6 years ago, I was on the coast on some rabbinical business, but I took time out and I visited the Japanese American National Museum that's in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. So there they have the whole history of Japanese immigration to America, including artifacts and pictures, including a whole floor on this very sad chapter in Japanese American history. There's no doubt it's very moving, it's very sad, and I know it's very unseemly even to begin to compare the suffering of various peoples, but I come at it from a Jewish perspective and from an American perspective. From an American perspective, it was very shameful, very insulting, very demeaning to them. From a Jewish perspective, I couldn't help thinking it wasn't the Holocaust. And it just, maybe it's just particular to us. There were no executions, obviously, and people died, but people died. There was no forced labor, although they did have to work. They were housed in barracks or small homes. They were allowed to take with them 2 suitcases of their belongings, but in fact they were incarcerated. Even in those little camps, they were behind fences most for the duration of the war. So it clearly seems unjust. None were ever accused of espionage. Assumptions were made. When we speak of internment, you know, we have, again, a little different perspective on it than others. Oddly enough, most of the affected Japanese Americans were West Coasters. Japanese Americans elsewhere in the U.S. served in the American military. Almost all of them fought in Europe. One unit, the 522nd Nisei Field Artillery Battalion, was even involved in the liberation of Dachau outside of Munich. And less well known, Canada also interned its Japanese civilians, but it didn't have any of the same tumult that took place in America. So, in any event, Fred Korematsu himself was rejected for the draft in 1940 because of medical issues, but he trained as a welder and he worked briefly in a Navy shipyard. Right after Pearl Harbor, he was fired. When he was ordered to report for detention, he refused. He went into hiding. He was subsequently arrested. The ACLU, it's been around, I think, for 700-800 years already, the ACLU sued on his behalf. In the meantime, Korematsu was tried, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to probation. But then he was deported, he and his family, to a detention facility in Utah. Korematsu claimed that his detention violated the 14th Amendment. He sued the Equal Protection Clause. He sued after he was convicted. And that the executive order under which he was imprisoned was unconstitutional. So it seems so obvious, right? The case came before the Supremes in 1944. And in December 1944, the court ruled 6-3 that the internment of Japanese Americans was constitutional. Constitutional. Justice Hugo Black wrote the opinion, arguing, not entirely convincingly, but as follows. He wrote, Korematsu was not excluded from the military area because of hostility to him or his race.
He was excluded because we are at war with the Japanese Empire, because the properly constituted military authorities feared an invasion of our West Coast and felt constrained to take proper security measures, because they decided that the military urgency of the situation demanded that all citizens of Japanese ancestry be segregated from the West Coast temporarily. And finally, because Congress, reposing its confidence in this time of war in our military leaders, as inevitably it must, determined that they should have the power to do just this. And Justice Black added, "We cannot reject as unfounded the judgment of the military authorities and of Congress that there were disloyal members of that population whose number and strength could not be precisely and quickly ascertained. We cannot say that the war-making branches of the government did not have ground for believing that, in a critical hour, such persons could not readily be isolated and separately dealt with, and constituted a menace to the national defense and safety, which demanded that prompt and adequate measures be taken to guard against it." That was the court's decision, 6-3. The Jewish justice at the time was Felix Frankfurter, an FDR protege, agreed. And he added a nuance, that such measures are also within the war-making powers of Congress. Congress declares war, has the power to wage war successfully. Therefore, Frankfurter wrote, "The validity of action under the war power must be judged wholly in the context of war. That action is not to be stigmatized as lawless, because like action in times of peace would be lawless." That was the court's decision. Justice Robert Jackson, who would later claim that the Constitution had a suicide pact, dissented. And the dissents are very powerful. Jackson wrote, "If any fundamental assumption underlies our system, it is that guilt is personal and not inheritable. Even if all of one's antecedents had been convicted of treason, the Constitution forbids its penalties to be visited upon him, for it provides that no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture, except during the life of the person attainted." That is to say, if a person in America is convicted of anything, you can't continue to punish that person's children and grandchildren. Jackson continues, "But here is an attempt to make an otherwise innocent act a crime merely because this prisoner is the son of parents, as to whom he had no choice, and belongs to a race from which there is no way to resign. If Congress, in peacetime legislation, should enact such a criminal law, I should suppose this court would refuse to enforce it." And then Jackson added something a little different. "It would be impracticable and dangerous idealism to expect or insist that each specific military command in an area of probable operations will conform to conventional tests of constitutionality. When an area is so beset that it must be put under military control at all, the paramount consideration is that its measures be successful rather than legal." Note again, echoes what he would write about the Constitution not being a suicide pact. It is to say, you want to win in war. Winning is more important than crossing every legal T and dotting every legal I. He didn't write that, but that's a good phrase. "The armed services must protect the society, not merely its constitution." Note again, he dissented from the decision, because he didn't think it reached that threshold whereby they could all be interned. "The very essence of the military job is to marshal physical force, to remove every obstacle to its effectiveness, to give it every strategic advantage. Defense measures will not and often should not be held within the limits that bind civil authority in peace. No court can require such a commander in such circumstances to act as a reasonable man. He may be unreasonably cautious and exacting. Perhaps he should be." Nonetheless, Jackson said, at this point, the courts have to review the decisions and pass on their constitutionality. And he said, you can't distort the Constitution to approve all that the military may deem expedient. But he is sensitive to the conflict. The most powerful and eloquent dissent came from Justice Frank Murphy. And he said, the exclusion of Japanese Americans, I quote, goes over the very brink of constitutional power and falls into the ugly abyss of racism. The military must be given great respect and consideration, and their judgments not overruled lightly. Remember, the war is still going on, by the way. This is December 1944. It must be conceded that the military and naval situation in the spring of 1942 was such as to generate a very real fear of invasion of the Pacific coast, accompanied by fears of sabotage and espionage in that area. The military command was therefore justified in adopting all reasonable means necessary to combat these dangers. But the exclusion, either temporarily or permanently, of all persons with Japanese blood in their veins has no such reasonable relation. And that relation is lacking because the exclusion order necessarily must rely for its reasonableness upon the assumption that all persons of Japanese ancestry may have a dangerous tendency to commit sabotage and espionage and to aid our Japanese enemy in other ways. It is difficult to believe that reason, logic, or experience could be marshaled in support of such an assumption. And then he added, I dissent, therefore, from this legalization of racism. Racial discrimination in any form and in any degree has no justifiable part whatever in our democratic way of life. It is unattractive in any setting, but it is utterly revolting among a free people who have embraced the principles set forth in the Constitution of the United States. All residents of this nation are kin in some way, by blood or culture, to a foreign land. We're a nation of immigrants. Yet they are primarily and necessarily a part of the new and distinct civilization of the United States. They must accordingly be treated at all times as the heirs of the American experiment and as entitled to all the rights and freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution. In fact, Murphy went on to say that the act of what was done to the Japanese echoes exactly the tactics, culture, and mentality of the enemy that we're fighting, and therefore can't be. People ask, Why it wasn't done to German Americans, only Japanese Americans. And two simple answers are there are too many German Americans, and they're not easily identified unless you have a stopwatch in your hand. You can't know who the Yeti is or not. But the Japanese are easily identifiable. Well, what happened to Korematsu versus United States? It was never overturned. It's still the law of the land. But Americans dealt with it in a very typical way. In 1988, President Reagan signed an act officially apologizing to Japanese Americans and awarding each victim $20,000 in reparations, a total paid of $1.2 billion. Korematsu was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Bill Clinton, and he died in 2005. One further point, it was revealed in the late 1970s, that the Solicitor General of the United States had fabricated evidence in the early 1940s, and that in fact the FBI had concluded that Japanese Americans posed no security threat at all. Nonetheless, that information, of course, was withheld, or it was not, did not play a meaningful role in the deliberations. And it was never overturned. It's still the law of the land, apparently. In effect, in what's a classic pattern in American history, many civil rights are violated in wartime and is left to the courts and the politicians to sort it out after things calm down. In effect, you have the best of both worlds, protection of society in wartime and the counterbalancing reaffirmation of civil liberties when the danger passes. It works out well, except for the victims. For the victims, doesn't work out as well. Now, just to bring it into our context a little more, keep in mind, for example, that Israeli Arabs, citizens of Israel, lived under military rule until 1966. That is to say, their actions, they were responsive to the military, the civil laws of Israel did not apply to them, including curfews and including administrative detention. But in none of Israel's wars did it ever intern its Arab civilians, whether citizens or non-citizens, as the U.S. had done, a little over a year before the Six-Day War broke out, when the military administration was lifted against Israeli Arabs, and technically then there is equality of citizenship between the Arab citizen and the Jewish citizen of Israel. And yet there really is no equality. To take the simplest example, Arab citizens are exempt from the army service, which is, and they're not sitting in Kollel either. They're exempt. Why? Because they're not trusted. So in other words, you have citizens of the state, full citizens of the state. There's an Arab Supreme Court justice now, and they're having plenty of Arabs in the Knesset, etc. Right, they could say they don't want to put them in a position of having to fight against their cousins and brothers, but the bottom line is they're not trusted to be in the service. The response of the security forces is always protect first and answer questions later. And it's no different than Israel today, nor in America today with the FBI. And that, at least in a Western context, all talk of a slippery slope, notwithstanding, the slope has never become so slippery that it is irreversible. So, what does the Torah say about all this? Well, it's more controversial even than it sounds. Israel's been in a minor frenzy the last 2 years since the publication by two Rosh Yeshiva in the Shomron of the Sefer called Torat HaMelech, a book that discusses, no holds barred, the Torah's approach to war, and in very bold, if not brazen terms, discusses the limited rights of enemy civilians in wartime. The Sefer itself was banned and removed from circulation. The authors were arrested. A number of rabbis, Rav Lior, for example, were arrested for writing a haskama to the book, and in one of those, again, a classic Israeli pattern, those cases are just pending. They'll be pending for years as a sword of Damocles to hold over the heads of the writers. But in the Sefer, it writes explicitly what has always been carried out very delicately. The restraints and limitations on enemy civilians, including a lack of regret over civilian casualties. The book advocates even a reluctance to avoid civilian casualties when militarily necessary operations are being carried out. Now, of course, that was quite characteristic of World War II. Think Dresden, think Hiroshima, think Nagasaki, but are today politically incorrect since such were outlawed by the Geneva Conventions post-World War II. Now, we have to understand the source of authority for Jews comes from the Torah, but in terms of statecraft, much of it is invested in the king. The Torah, it's arguable whether the Torah endorses a monarchy, it's a machlokas rishonim, but everybody holds that the Torah certainly permits it. Although the king does not have absolute power in every sphere, he's certainly powerful. And his main authority, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Malachim u'Mechamoseihem, Perek Dalet Halacha Yud, Lishbar Zroa Harashayim u'Lilachem u'Chamos Hashem. The main task of the king is to break the strength of the wicked and fight God's battles. Shein mamlichin melech tchila elolasas mishpat u'milchamos. A king is only appointed ab initio to do justice and to fight wars. Hence the name, Hilchos Melachim u'milchamoseihem. The king is in the war business. Although, for optional wars, the Sanhedrin is a check on the king's power. But the king has power. One of the ways we'll understand our topic tonight is by starting with a look at the power of the Melucha in ordinary times. So Ram writes in Perek Dalet Halacha Beis, of Hilchos Melachim, the king has the power, the Shalach b'chol Gvul Yisrael. He could send emissaries throughout the land of Israel. He could take the strong, powerful people, just in every tribe. He can make them the riders of his chariots, his horsemen. He could take big Jews just to stand in front of him. Umami mehenan Hashem larutz lefanav. He can designate others to run before him. Shenemar v'sam lo b'merkav v'farashav. V'rutz l'flame merkavta. The king had people run before him. You may remember from the Megillas Esther. One of the things that Mordechai asked for, someone should walk before the chariot. Lokach min hayofim shebohem. Liel shamashim v'omdim lefanav. He could take handsome people, beautiful people, to work for him, to stand before him in the palace, make himself look good by comparison. In other words, the king in normal times is allowed to seize people to his purposes, conscription into his army, for his honor, for his service. Obviously, he'd be allowed to intern people on that same basis. And that's just based on the rights and prerogatives of the Melucha. Now, others disagree with the Rambam, like the Nimuka Yosef in Nedarim Daf Chav Zayin Amud Aleph, or the Chuvus in the Bali Tosus Yud Beis from Chaim Or Zerua, the son of the famous Or Zerua, Bitzvah Or Zerua and Kuf Yud, all based on the opinion there's no obligation to appoint a king. It's permissible, but not obligatory. And according to that, that ascribes limited powers to the king. The king's authority is limited to monetary matters. That's the base of Dina Mechus Adina outside the Jewish context, because the land belongs to him. Of course, the land of Israel does not belong to the king of Israel. It belongs to every Jew. But even they would agree, once the king is appointed, and he and the Sanhedrin agree on a particular course of conduct, then in fact it is legal and enforceable. By the way, keep in mind that the king has the right to wage war. But for an optional war, he needs the permission of the Sanhedrin. Generally, the Sanhedrin is a check on the king's power. Here, the needs of society take precedence over the needs of the individual. Remember from last time, it differs from our discussion of libel law, Lashon Hara, because in matters of Lashon Hara, there usually is no societal imperative. When it comes to security, the individual has to sacrifice. That's why they have people in the army. They die to protect the tzibur. Because if the tzibur is lost, the individual is lost also. But these are not unilateral decisions. They involve the Beis Sinagoga, the Sanhedrin, which was both a spiritual and a legislative body. So we can root the king's power to do actions similar to internment, first in Melucha, and secondly in the king's powers of Milchama. The king's powers to wage war are mostly unlimited. Rashi says at the end of Bereishis, at the end of Vayikra, according to Sifra, it's the beginning of Chukosai, Inein Shalom, Ein Klum. If there's no peace, there's nothing. So therefore, whatever restores peace to the Jewish world is vital. Nothing matters at all if the nation is defeated. And so the Abarbanel writes in the Shmuel Aleph, the king in battle against the enemies in Israel, enemies of Israel, must be cruel, achzari. There's a time for rachamim and a time for achzarius, cruelty. And war is the time for as much ruthlessness as is necessary to win. What did Shlomo say? Eis milchama veis shalom. It's not the same. Never construe eis milchama as eis shalom. It's a sure way to defeat. The Netziv writes in Bereishis that war is essentially a heter etzicha. It permits men to kill other men. And he says that's the derech olmos, the way of the world. And an enemy is an enemy, even if technically a civilian. But we come to a third, and I think the strongest basis for understanding the Torah's approach to these matters, and that is the halachic doctrine of hara'as sha'ah, of exigency. In emergencies, the law is temporarily suspended. Hara'as sha'ah is a very far-reaching halachic construct. Makin va'onshin shelomin adin. You can beat someone, flog someone, punish them extra judicially. Lefiksor hashah, Rivash writes, as the time demands it, whether the king or the Beis Din, even to kill someone, shelomin adin. The king has the right. The Sanhedrin has the right. Certainly they have the right to take less drastic measures. Harashah means that the authorities will act in a way that will ordinarily violate the Torah. Now, though, it's imperative. Eis lasos lashem hefer torasecha. There's a time we have to act for God, even to nullify the Torah, because the whole Torah will be lost. That is to say, Eis lasos lashem, we can violate particulars of the Torah system in order to save the system itself. And the Rambam writes in Hilchos Mamrim, Perek Beis Halacha Dalid, and it's really a quite extensive power. Yesh lebeisin lakar af dvorim elufi shah af apishu katam in arishonim. Beisin has the right to uproot anything, any law, temporarily, even if it's a beisin made up of, going with a small gimel, not a capital gimel like we have today. Shelo yehu gzeros elu chamur midivrei Torah atzma. That these decrees cannot be more severe than what Torah says itself. Shafilu divrei Torah yesh lechol beisin la'akar horashah. The Chacham have the right to suspend even a Torah law temporarily for some exigent need. Ketzad, for example, based in Shelro Lachazek Hadas Vilasa Syog Kadeshol Yavra Amal Divrei Torah, based on wants to strengthen some aspect of our faith and make a fence around a Torah law so people should not violate the Doraisa. Makin Va'on Shashlokadin, they could punish people even against Halacha. Like Shimon ben Shatach, for example, executed dozens of witches in one day, even though Based is only affecting one person a day. No, it's Harasha. Execute a person riding a horse on Shabbos. Even if this is Rabbana, not a Daraisa. Just an example. Abel Ein Kovin Adobel Adoros. Borim Shalacha Kafi. But what they can't do is say, this is the new halacha forever. That they can't do. V'cheinim ro l'fi sho l'vato mitzvah seh o lavro mitzvah lo seh kadeh l'hachzer am l'daz. If they see temporarily the need to nullify a positive commandment or to violate a prohibition in order to restore people to the faith. O l'hatzil rabba mi Yisrael mili kasher b'dvar macherim, or to save many Jews from stumbling. They do what they have to do. The famous case of Elio, Har Carmel, building a mizbeach. Harasha. Kishem shaharofe chotech yado raglo shel zeh kedei sheyichya kulo. Just like a doctor sometimes has to amputate a hand or a foot so the body will live. Kach based in morim bizman in azmanim lava ktsas mitzvos b'bishah kedei sheyiskaimu kulom. So too, the basin has the right of time to time, temporarily, to violate a number of mitzvos, again, temporarily, so the rest can be upheld. As the Chachamim said elsewhere, Chalel Olav Shabbos Achas, Kedei Sheyishma Shabbos Harbe. The reason why we say we can violate Shabbos to save a life, violate this Shabbos, so the person will observe many Shabbosos. The Kesef Mishnah adds here, but this is so postulate, it's so obvious, it need not have been written. And it was only written to teach us that these temporary measures can never become permanent parts of the Torah and exceed the law of the Torah itself. But yet, that is the way the system is set up. The system is never allowed to self-destruct. It can't. Therefore, Chazal have to fine-tune it on occasion in order to maintain the whole. Ragvaz writes in his Truvos, in Chelek Aleph, Simon Kuf Pei Zayin, the question was asked to him, you had a large number of avaryonim, sinners, gross sinners. And Berah, from time to time, Beis Din would come down very hard on sinners, literally beating them. Ragvaz is the 1500s. But you had in medieval times, even in the beginning of the 20th century, Batei Din in the exile would execute people. The last happened, by the way, in Russia in the early part of the second decade of the 20th century. And you know, the czars, they never cared. If you want to kill the Jews, kill them. They wanted to do it, so they did their work for them. But in fact, the reason was to establish standards for society. So the question came to Ravaz, their people, these are avaryonim, the basin wants to punish them, but they said if they punish them, they'll just convert to Islam. Should they punish them? What should they do? So Ravaz writes, you have to be aware, you have to use your seichel, but that's not a reason not to uphold the norms of society. You listen to what he writes. Devadai mutal aleinu l'kayim torasenu v'yiyem ma sheyi acharkach. Our obligation is to uphold the Torah, and what happens afterwards happens. And then he adds, the Afal Gav Shekasafti Kol Zel Alocha. Even I write, this is the din. Mikomakom Yesh Lemanik Hador Lios Matun Bidvar Meila. The leaders of the generation must be very deliberate in these matters. L'fishein Kol Hanashim Shavin V'lo Kol Haveros Shavos. Not everyone is equal, not every sin is equal. You have to use your seichel, and you have to be very aware of what each step, will it help, will it hurt. So the punishment has to be reasonable, it has to be a benefit, it has to be done with a forethought, and it has to be done l'shem shamayim. We are even permitted, of course, to anticipate an attack. We don't have to wait to be attacked. We don't have to wait for the mushroom cloud. A preemptive strike is mutar lahalacha. Even a preemptive defensive move is permissible. Like the Ramah writes in Shin Chof Tes in Or HaChaim, even on Shabbos. Afil lo bo adayin, el erotzim lavo. Even if the enemy is not yet attacked, but we know they want to come, we can desecrate Shabbos and preempt them. All of this is in keeping with the king's mandate, as the Chinuch writes in Tov Tzadi Zayin, L'maleya sa'olam tzedek v'lishbor zroa harishoyim. Again, echoing the Rambam, to fill the world with justice and shatter the might of the wicked. So again, there is an element of the paradox here. We're trying to fill the world with justice by doing something that in ordinary times would be considered unjust. Now, granted, many of the Harasha statements refer to situations in which the Torah is being wantonly violated and the authorities want to halt or reverse that spiritual decline. It's Chol Shabbos or moral matters. Those are the classics. But the principle is the same. We have to protect the Jewish people in the long term. We have to deter attacks in the distant future, as well as revenge attacks from the vanquished in the near future. So that doesn't demand that we drop a nuclear bomb on every enemy. In fact, the Gemara Shavuos says that Lamed Hamed Beis, Gemara posits that the Jewish army should not kill more than a sixth of the enemy. That is to say, you can't depopulate the world in order to save the Jewish people. And you cannot ordinarily kill civilians, nor can you even confiscate their property without some vital necessity. So every action has to be weighed. The military requirement on the one hand, versus the wisdom of not turning the entire population into enemies on the other hand. So for example, we always have to have a mechanism by which peace or surrender is possible. The Torah says the Jewish siege, for example, only surrounded three sides of the city. You have to allow a fourth, allow people to escape. If there's no escape, then they will inevitably fight to the death. We don't want that either. We lose lives too. So whatever move is taken has to be rooted in some operational necessity and not just vengeance or anger or arrogance. Rav Yosef Albo wrote in the Sefer Karm, the first Maimer, Perek Dalid, he says, Ki ha-melech yesh la'el yado la'avor al ha-chok v'lasas ma she-yirtze kidei la-hoshia es-amo. The king has the right to do whatever in his power to break the law, to do what he wants to save the Jewish people. Now I know this was homiletic. It's a reference to God, that God can change the chok of nature in order to save Klal Yisrael. Miracle. But nonetheless, it's very germane to our discussion. The king can break the law to save the nation. His job is saving the nation. All this seems obvious, but what gives us room for pause is that the extrajudicial acts or punishments of the king or the Sanhedrin must be based on some reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing on the part of the accused, or at least knowledge of a crime or a sin that can't be proven, there are no edim. That, for the most part, was missing in Karamatsu. There was just an assumption that all Japanese would be disloyal. The dilemma that brought about Karamatsu is similar but not identical to Israel's conundrum. For sure, some Japanese Americans were spies, but not all, not even most, and not even many. Today, few Israeli Arabs have joined in any of the wars against Israel since 1967, although for sure there have been Israeli Arabs who have been very active participants in terrorist attacks in the last decade and a half. You may recall a few dozen such Rishoyim were released last month in exchange for Gilad Shalit. Israeli Arabs carry Israeli identity cards and yellow license plates. They go anywhere in the country and they find it very easy. One of their ways, there have been some Israeli Arab suicide bombers also, but their classic way of participation in terror is to transport Arabs from Yudan Shomron in their yellow license plates vehicles into Israel proper, or simply providing them with some refuge after their dastardly deeds have been committed. But still, even most Israeli Arabs don't participate in terror. Are they sympathetic to the Arab cause? What do you think? I would imagine yes, but most adamantly refuse to live in any Palestinian state, even to move in and out to an Arab country. There's a big question on them. If things were so bad in Israel, I mean, the gates are open, go live in Syria if it's such a paradise. Go live in Algeria, go to Yemen, go to Saudi Arabia. No. The fact is, they like living in a free Israel, although they would never admit it. But can they be trusted? That's the question that faces Israel and faces America, and certainly faced America in the 1940s. And as I mentioned before, the fact that they're categorically exempted from service in the IDF, it's clear, although unspoken, that the trust is not there. The bottom line is, war always works best in peacetime, and wartime causes reevaluations and occasionally stark departures from the normal. Fourthly, a hostile population can even be deemed rodfim, pursuers, clear and present dangers to the polity. Now this notion is an outgrowth of what we read in the Torah this week, in Vayishlach, the Shimon and Levi's massacre of the city of Shechem. So not the whole city wasn't guilty what Shechem did, but they were guilty. The Rambam says, of not enforcing the Sheva Mitzvah Noah, after all, Shechem had kidnapped Dina. The Ramban says they're guilty of being Rishon and threats to society. So the analysis of Machlokas is beyond the scope here, but there are distinctions between the Rambam and the Ramban. At least according to the Rambam, though, the idea of a person being a Rodef indirectly, or even a Suffolk Rodef, or even in fact a Rodef Ba'onis against his will, is plausible, and sometimes the treatment of those people is unpleasant but necessary. Certainly a population that only tacitly supports the enemy, gives aid, comfort, shelter, material support, is to be construed as hostile. In President Bush's immortal words, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. There really is no middle ground. And given the exigencies of a particular situation, even collective punishment becomes justifiable, essential, even if distasteful. So what's in last week's news? The Senate passed a bill essentially calling for the indefinite detention of American citizens suspected of terror. Again, American citizens suspected of terror. It passed the Senate overwhelmingly, I think 60-38, something like that. Lindsey Graham said, and listen again to the echoes of Korematsu, the enemy is all over the world, here at home, and when people take up arms against the United States and are captured within the United States, why should we not be able to use our military and intelligence community to question that person as to what they know about enemy activity? They should not be read their Miranda rights. They should not be given a lawyer. They should be held humanely in military custody and interrogated about why they joined Al-Qaeda and what they were going to do to all of us. Azazot Lindsey Graham. Now, there was only two Republicans voted against it. 16 Democrats supported it, Joe Lieberman as well, but one of the people that supported it, Daniel Inouye. Daniel Inouye is now 87 years old, a Japanese-American raised in Hawaii who fought in Europe for the American Army during World War II, lost his arm in battle, and he voted essentially for what interned his own people during the war, but in a different context. Now the context is terror. A bill that provides for the indefinite detention at Guantanamo or elsewhere of American citizens suspected of terror. Obama has threatened to veto it. Usually the first time in American history, of course he's a man of the left, but it's the first time in American history that a president has rejected powers offered to him in order to effect the security of the American people. So be it. Korematsu was decided as the war was still going on, but was dealt with as Americans have traditionally dealt with a loss of civil liberties during wartime. As Radvaz wrote, Vade mutol aleinu l'kaim torasenu v'yiyeh ma sheyiyeh achar kach. We do it, we pick up the pieces later, pay money to the victims with a profuse apology, a statement of outrage, and the expectation that the exact same process will recur, if necessary, in the future. Witness the civil liberties violations or deviations in the wake of the wave of Arab terror in the last decade or so. Indeed, the Constitution is not the suicide pact, and nor is the Torah a suicide pact. Indeed, it is true as well, as the axiom goes, hard cases make bad law. Korematsu is such a hard case that made bad law, but occasionally even bad law is necessary for the welfare and the preservation of society. I thank you all very much. Next week we will dip our toes in the cauldron of race relations in America and look at the case of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas Board of Education and the Torah's views on race inequality. I thank you all very much.